sex in the context of marriage is not, I want what I want when I want it.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In these weekly broadcasts of Christianity at Work, Jack and Christine will strive together in an extemporaneous dialogue to understand the practical issues, questions, and struggles of everyday life in the light of the truth of the gospel. Here now are Jack and Christine, continuing their series on biblical sexual ethics.
In our discussions in the area of sexuality, Jack, we're kind of settling on the area of self-control. Last week we talked a lot about self-control pretty much as a general subject. Today, what we'd like to do is talk about self-control in the context of marriage. Now, that could be kind of a foreign concept to a lot of people. A lot of people may think, what do you mean self-control in marriage? It seems like when I got married, then I have the freedom to be the sexual person that I've always wanted to be.
Yeah, I think it's not uncommon for Christians in particular who've had some kind of sense that they're supposed to exercise self-control in the area of their sexuality when they're single, who are looking forward to marriage where they can have kind of unrestrained access to sexual gratification whenever they want to. And that is just not the reality. Marriage does not mean that I don't exercise self-control. There's all kinds of reasons why when I might be interested in a sexual encounter with my spouse, it's just not possible. It's either not practical or it may not be appropriate morally because it would not be consistent with what's kind and what's loving, what's considerate to the other person.
So let's come up with two examples. What do you mean it might not be practical? And the other, it might not be moral. Could you give me two different examples?
Well, for example, if for some reason circumstances has separated us and we just literally are not physically in the same location, then, okay, what now? I mean, I'm married, that's true, but I'm still having to abstain from any sexual relationship because the only one that I could righteously have a sexual relationship with is my spouse and we're physically separated for some reason. That's one option. Morally, it may not be appropriate because...
Let's go back to practical for a minute. Okay. So that might be obvious to some people. Well, of course, I can't have sex if I'm not with my spouse. But what if I'm with my spouse? What are some, you know, we're in the same house, and what are some practical considerations that I might really need to be looking to here?
Middle of the night, our fairly young child gets sick and comes into our bed, you know, the husband and wife's bed, to be comforted and to be taken care of, or has a nightmare and needs comfort and comes into the parents' bed. Never mind that husband or wife might have been looking forward to a sexual encounter that evening, I guess God had other plans, because it just becomes impractical or at least immoral in a situation like that where the child is present in the room. It just makes it impossible to be sexually intimate. Yeah, you know, sometimes the border between impractical and immoral gets difficult to define, but let's say one or the other is just not really physically feeling very well. They're not feeling so bad that a sexual encounter would be impossible, but they're not interested because they feel so badly. Does that mean that the other partner should get to have sex because they want to have sex? Well, no. I mean, do I get to have sex because I want to have sex? not if my wife is not interested because of any number of circumstances in her life. But that's kind of bordering up on what I'm talking about immoral. If it would be selfish and unkind of me to demand sex because I want it, that's the kind of moral constraint that persists right through marriage. The question is it right and appropriate morally now, at this time in these circumstances, all things considered? And oftentimes the answer is no, it's not. And thus, self-control is in order.
So what you're saying, Jack, is when we get married, it isn't just when I want sex that I get to have it. It isn't then sex on demand.
Exactly. That's right. Even though we often can have that kind of expectation naively, but nonetheless, it can be a very powerful expectation. And it can lead to a great deal of resentment and bitterness between people. If they come into their marriage with that expectation, particularly because if we put the other person's willingness, their readiness to have sex into the equation, then I can start blaming them because they're not willing, they're not ready, they're uncooperative. I guess that's when people got divorced for cause in times past, and they got divorced for reasons of sexual incompatibility. I would imagine partly that's what people meant by that, is that I wanted to have sex and the other person didn't when I wanted to. Now, it probably got more extreme than that, but the seed of that is in my having expectations that I ought to be able to have sex whenever I want to, and if my partner is not accommodating that, then shame on them. I get angry, I get bitter, I get resentful. I fall into self-pity because they are not cooperating with my expectations and my desires.
So, Jack, what are some ways you can imagine that a man or a woman might demand sex from their partner? What does that look like?
I don't know if I have enough experience talking to other people. You might, from your experience, have more experience to draw on to answer that question.
Well, it seems like there's a gazillion different ways that people can demand and do demand. One of them that I hear from Christians quite often is this. What we're talking about here is, you know, we got married and now your body isn't your own, it's mine, and you are biblically obligated, morally obligated to give me sex. And if you don't, you're wrong. Another way that a man, especially a Christian man, I've heard of Christian men using is saying, you know, your responsibility is to be a submissive wife. Submit to me in this area. I have a right to demand it. God gave me that right as the head of the home. I would say to those people, instead of going into an answer to that right at this point, to refer people again to our tapes on headship and submission, because we really do deal with this in quite a bit of detail. Another way that someone could demand is by giving the silent treatment, is by humiliating them in public, saying something like, you're no good in bed anyway, or, you know, do something that's demeaning or degrading to the other people or to the other person, or exposing of them to other people in an inappropriate context. They could demand it by humiliating the person in private, trying to coerce them into having sexual relationship with them, just to keep them, you know, someone will have sex with their partner just to keep them from being demeaning toward them in private, criticizing perhaps a body part or the way they function sexually. So there's just a whole lot of ways, but those are just some that come to my mind right off the bat.
All of that is horrible. I mean, it's manipulative, it's coercive, it's selfish, it's oppressive, it's cruel. There's any number of ways in which evil is manifesting itself in all of those examples that you gave. But the key to all of them is to understand going into marriage, to have different expectations coming into marriage, and that is sexuality is not for me, it's for the Lord. Just like every other aspect of my life, I am to serve God and His values and His purposes in the context of a sexual relationship. And what that means is that I'm striving to be loving toward the one I have committed my life to, and not
coercive, not demanding, not humiliating,
not exploitive, not using my spouse as an object for sexual gratification, but to let them be a person on their own clock, on their own schedule, in their own set of circumstances, responding to life the way they're responding to life, and whatever that means for their sexual availability, that I accept as ordained by God ultimately.
Okay, so I can hear somebody screaming in their head and saying, what do you mean? If you put it that way, then my husband or wife will never want to have sex with me because they're never ready. They're never interested. I have a much more heightened sexual desire than they do. And what, am I just supposed to wait my whole life?
Well, if that's true, then ultimately the answer would have to be, I guess so. I don't think that that's altogether true. I think often what we'll find is people become more sexually responsive when they're outside the pressure of having to be exploited and manipulated and coerced and so on. Coercion is not exactly a turn-on. It's not exactly endearing. It's not exactly something that makes sexuality attractive to people. So there's all kinds of changes that could happen when I change my attitude. But take a worst-case scenario. Let's say that God has, and as it turns out, God has put me in a marriage where I'm going to end up being virtually celibate for the rest of my life. That's one of the questions that I had to ask myself going into marriage. What if this doesn't work out sexually? What if this isn't a sexually satisfying marriage? Am I willing to commit my life to this woman or this man to be the man or woman to them that God has asked me to be and has called me to be, and commit my life to them, to get to know them and respect them no matter what, no matter what happens sexually in our experience? That's a question I should be asking myself even going into a marriage. Imagine the worst case scenario. It's not particularly a gratifying sexual relationship. Does that make it wrong? Does it spoil my marriage? Well, it may be deficient in one respect as a marriage. On the one hand, on the other hand, marriage is not about my comfort. It's not about my happiness. Marriage will never fulfill me anyway. What my life is all about is learning to know and love God and follow Him and be the person of integrity that He is wanting to make me into. That's what's going to be ultimately fulfilling in my life. And if God, who is wise, understands that one of the tools He's going to use, one of the vehicles He's going to use to make me into that wise person of integrity, is a marriage where I have to be deprived of sexual gratification, then so be it. And that's the attitude I ultimately need to take.
In that worst case scenario, what our culture would say is, look, if the other person is unwilling to gratify you sexually, if they're unwilling to enter into a sexual relationship that you want, then you have the right to leave. So what you're saying, from a biblical perspective, is radically different than what our world says. We really don't have the option to break our vow.
Right.
In this respect. What we have is the commitment to love another person, and even bigger than that is our commitment above that is to love God. Loving God in this context may mean that I have to learn about self-control in a way that I never knew I'd have to or never imagined before. And that's what God wants in my life. That's how He's trying to mature me. That's how He's trying to grow me up. And this marriage that I'm in, where I'm not being gratified sexually, is where He has me. It is my classroom for learning.
Yeah, I think it's important to say that it doesn't mean that I cannot communicate my desires to my spouse and together work on it and work it through. If I'm married to someone who's not willing to work it through at all, that's not much of a marriage. And there's more problems than just sexual availability.
Yes. That's just one symptom of a problem.
Exactly. Yeah.
Though, Jack, I think before we were talking about someone being demanding, and that's when the real problems come in, is it's very appropriate for us to be working together on working through our whole, the whole area of sexuality in our marriage. But for me to work it through, so to speak, by demanding or coercing the other person is not working it through at all.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, that's not working it through. That's manipulation, like we said earlier. Yeah.
And I want to piggyback on something that you said earlier is very often a person doesn't want to be sexual with their spouse when they're being demanded. They don't have the freedom to just choose. They're being pushed and forced. They're not being valued as a separate individual who's needing and wanting, and it's appropriate for them to make their own choices. And so very often they're reacting either on a real conscious level or sometimes not even aware that they're reacting to the demandingness of their spouse. And there's a lot of almost magic that happens when we decide just to stop demanding. However, if I'm the person that's demanding, what I'm going to probably fall into is a whole lot of myself when I stop demanding. I am perhaps really relieving my anxiety by trying to get you to be sexual with me, my spouse to be sexual with me. And when I drop that, I'm left with not being able to be gratified sexually. And whatever that means to me, it's probably pretty big for me to have coerced and demanded and really hurt and sinned against my spouse to the degree that I have. Very often sex can be used as kind of a way to avoid other parts of life that are very difficult. It can be used kind of like alcohol is used to kind of mute difficult things in our life. So also is having sex. It can be something that can mute other things that make me very anxious in my life. And if I give up forcing my spouse to do it, then I'm having to face into those things in a big way. And usually when we find ourselves coercing another person, or perhaps always, I think I want to hedge on the always, is it really has more to do with issues that I'm trying to walk aside or walk around in my life. And I'm trying to get you to be kind of the buffer from the things that I really need to be looking at and working with and facing in my life.
Be my escape, be my drug.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's good.
This program is produced by the McKenzie Study Center in Eugene, Oregon. The McKenzie Study Center was established in 1979 as a campus ministry near the University of Oregon. Since its beginning, it has focused its attention on encouraging, assisting, and equipping Christians with the tools to understand the Bible. McKenzie offers classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes, and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. The heart of the Study Center teaching ministry is the Tuesday night lectures. One of our classic Tuesday lecture series is Dr. Jack Crabtree's exposition of the Book of Romans. Other topics include marriage and sexuality, biblical interpretation, modern challenges to Christianity, and of course, the radical nature of the gospel. The Study Center also has numerous articles which may help many in their growth as Christians. For example, in her article, Pain and Glory, staff member Nancy Scott reveals her struggles with God when her mother was severely disabled with a major stroke, and what she learned from her mother's suffering, as well as her own. All of the lectures and articles are available. Listen at the end of the program for information on how you can order tapes, articles, or a copy of this program.
I wouldn't want to leave the impression that in order for a sexual encounter, sexual intimacy to happen within a marriage relationship, both people need to be really eager for that. I can offer sex to my wife as a gift, as she can offer sex to me as a gift as well. That I think a sexual intimacy within the context of marriage comes in different shapes and in different colors and in different flavors. I mean, not every sexual encounter is like the last one. And that's part of the wonder and the kind of the mystery of sexuality is that it can have such different complexions. It can be almost mundane at times, and it can be almost transcendent at times. It just it is so responsive to circumstances and moods and
life stresses.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not that one and only one kind is valid and the others are not valid. Its complexion is going to be very different. What makes it valid is if it's an act of an integrity between two people who respect one another, who are coming together to communicate their commitment to one another. If it has that, well, I mean, back up, it has that meaning anyway. But if there's respect, mutual respect there, and not cruelty, exploitation, selfishness going on, then it's a valid sexual act within marriage. It doesn't have to be passionate, and not both people need to be really interested in order for it to be a valid sexual encounter. But it has to be freely given, that's what I'm arguing. I don't have to be interested, but I have to be giving it freely. If somebody is taking it from me, then shame on them. I mean, that's selfish of the person who's demanding it of me.
Now, if they're taking it from me, that's wrong. It's also wrong for me to be taken from. Equally as wrong for me to give in out of fear of what might happen if I don't. So we're both very dependent in that regard. We're both very fused in an inappropriate way when we enter into a sexual relationship or sexual encounter, either of us, either giving in or demanding. Now there is we can both mutually agree and choose to give sexually, even though one of us may not want it as much as the other person. That's not a giving in. That's a deciding to be loving. That's a choice to be caring. That's a choice to do what I believe in my own head, with my own values, with my own beliefs. That's right. And so I can enter into it that way. But that's very different than giving in because I'm afraid of what might happen if I don't. They could look the same. Someone from the outside that can't understand the in workings of my own thinking process wouldn't be able to see it. But I need to have integrity with that.
So you would put it as strongly as it's wrong to be taken from, in the sense that it would be moral inappropriate for me to be taken advantage of and be demanded of. And
I think I only can be taken advantage of, Jack, to the extent that I let myself. Now, there are extenuating circumstances. If there's somebody who's raping me against my will because they're stronger than me, and they're physically overpowering me, I really am a victim there. And there are some circumstances where that's true. But on an emotional level, I need to work toward non-victimization. I need to work toward becoming a person who's making a choice to be loving. Not a person that's kicking and screaming and ending up rebellious and angry and resentful toward their spouse because I've given in so long and done so much for them. Well, I haven't done so much for them. I haven't loved them. In doing that, I don't develop my own sense of self, my own values, what I believe, what I think is right, what's good. What I do is I capitulate into doing what they want, and eventually I really don't have much to give because real giving is giving out of a strength of personhood. And that's really the paradox, is it's in me being a strong, fully functioning, mature person. In that position, I can give so much more than I can from a weakened position where I don't have a sense of my own self, my beliefs, my values, what's important.
Okay, yeah, I think I see what you're saying. If out of weakness and fear I am taken from, I may not be able to avoid that, and I may not be culpable for being taken from, but I haven't done anything virtuous either. It's only virtuous of me if out of the strength of loving another person I offer something to them.
What do you mean I may not be culpable for that? How might I not be responsible for that?
Well, the extreme of that, of course, is rape.
Oh, okay.
For example, I'm not guilty because I was raped.
Right.
And I suppose there are degrees of kind of coercion and oppression and taking advantage of where I really didn't have a choice in a sense, But I'm just concerned, are we making people like that culpable, blameworthy for what has actually happened to them? And maybe not, but there's no virtue in me being fearful and weak. There's no virtue in that. I need to work toward, as you said, I need to work toward that condition of doing what I'm doing because I want to honor God, obey Him, love other people, do what's right, do what's good, regardless of the circumstances. That's where I always need to head toward.
Head toward. And you're right, there are places where I don't feel culpable and places where it's hard to tell that I don't feel culpable or I'm not culpable. I'm not responsible where I'm just physically being overpowered. I there's times when I just cannot do anything about it. There's other times when, from a psychological perspective, I feel like I can't do anything about it. And the feeling seems like I can't. But the words what we're both using is, I need to work toward being able to take responsibility. That might be a really long road for me, but I need to become a person who is strong and who is capable to take responsibility for myself. And that could be a very, very long road for some people and a very, very difficult process. For a lot of people, though, they just don't want to risk the possibility of some kind of loss, and so they give in. Risk the possibility of some kind of humiliation. Risk the possibility of being seen as a certain kind of person. So they're not willing to take a risk that really they could take if they were willing to pay the cost for it.
Yeah, I think I see what you're saying.
So just to bring us back where we were, Jack, is we're saying that self-control is something that we need to have in the context of marriage as well as outside the context of marriage. But we're really focusing on in the context of marriage, and there's not a place to either demand, that's not appropriate, and there's really not a place to say it's okay just to give myself up here, to give in to the demand. I need to be working toward not just giving in, but working toward being a person who is choosing to be in a loving, giving, strong relationship with my spouse.
Yeah, I guess this is what you've been just talking about here. But whereas we might be inclined to think, well, it's loving just to keep giving and giving and giving, say to my husband, or but maybe it's to my wife. The fact of the matter is, if what you're giving to is just my selfishness, if my wife is just giving to my selfishness, she's not really in the end helping me. Because I need to come to terms with this terrible self-centered attitude that I've got, this terrible perspective on sexuality that I've got, this terrible perspective on myself that I've got, this whole attitude that I should have what I want. And by my wife insisting that sexuality in our marriage relationship be respectful and be morally responsible and morally appropriate, and by demanding that I be responsive to the circumstances and the restraints and the limitations that life itself has put on my sexual gratification, by expecting that of me and demanding of that of me, she's basically demanding that I be a decent, God-fearing, righteous, godly individual. And that's a good thing to demand of me, not a bad thing to demand of me.
Well, wait a minute. We're using the word demand and expect in a different context, and I think that can be very confusing.
All right.
So let's use a different word. I think the meaning of what you're saying is that instead of the wife, in this example, giving in to the husband's demand to be sexual, the wife needs to do what's good and what's right in relationship to him, and that's not giving in to what his demands are. It's not demanding that he be something, but it's demanding of herself, perhaps, that she work toward doing what's right.
It is a reasonable expectation of a wife for her husband, as it is a husband for his wife. It is a reasonable expectation of a wife for her husband that he would want to serve and obey his God. That is not being unkind to him. it is not being, well, I know how men think about this thing or can think about this thing. They can see their wife as being, by being unavailable, as being unkind and not nice and not forthcoming, not giving with respect to the man. The woman, if she gets herself in that frame of mind, could feel guilty, could feel that, yes, I'm not being kind, I'm not being what I should be here, I'm not being forthcoming here. Never mind that the reality is, I'm not interested. I shouldn't allow the circumstances of my life to dictate my availability and my interest. I should just allow my husband's desire to dictate that. And could give in out of that kind of, I mean, a sense of moral obligation. My whole point is...
A misdirected sense of moral obligation.
A misdirected sense of moral obligation. Because her moral obligation, the moral obligation that both husband and wife together are under, is let's live our life together in respect for one another under the sovereign direction of a God who's ordering our circumstances. If God has so ordered our life and our circumstances that I'm not interested in a sexual encounter, it's His fault, not my fault. I mean, that there's a sense in which I have to shift the blame for my circumstances onto God and deal with Him, decide what I'm going to do about that. Because that's the truth. That's the fact of the matter. And so rather than the husband blame his wife and try to get his wife to change in order to change the circumstances, something that's very unreasonable for him to do, and instead of the wife taking that perspective herself, I think she needs to take the perspective that if circumstances, not me, but if circumstances has made it so my husband is going to go without sex here, then he needs to face into the need to grow up in relationship to God and accept from God's hand what God has given. That's not an unloving thing for a wife to expect of her husband. It's not too much to ask for him to be wise, to be mature, to be godly. And that, I use the word demand there, but if you understand what I'm saying then, is that kind of expectation that deal with your God, husband. Work with Him. Live before Him as a righteous and godly man. I'm not asking anything of you that God is not asking of you. I'm not asking anything of you that's inappropriate of me to ask.
Though, Jack, it may not be verbalized in that way at all. From the wife's perspective, her wanting or her expectation of her husband to deal with the issues in his life that come up when he's not getting the kind of sexual gratification that he wants could be communicated just by her deciding to grow up herself. That instead of giving in all the time from his demands because she is weak or lazy or afraid, that she'll decide to grow up. And whatever that means, she won't be giving in to what he wants. And that will not necessarily take any words on her part. In fact, maybe it's better that it wouldn't take words for her to say, grow up and follow your God.
Yeah, in fact, I would argue, I mean, none of that I said should ever be communicated verbally. No, I'm just talking about her own set of expectations inside of her own head. Yeah. The problem is, the reason I put it that way is because it's so easy for her to hear another voice that comes through attitudes and sometimes words from her husband, making her feel like she should feel guilty here for not being available. Well, is it her fault she's not available? What are the circumstances of her life? And who's to blame for that? Not her. It's not reasonable for her to be available in certain sets of circumstances.
And I'll agree with you there that sometimes it's not reasonable for her to be available, say in times when she's sick or not wanting to be available because she's just being coerced or forced or manipulated or humiliated or acted against in a hateful or hurtful way. In those times, it those are different than maybe she's just not even pursuing trying to develop her own sexuality. And if that's the case, I imagine there's several other reasons why a woman could be available but isn't. But there are times when she needs to say, there is a problem here, and I need to work on it.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And not just, well, this is the way God has it. Well, it's also, this is a place where maybe God has it, but he also wants me to grow up.
Right.
And so we're both in this context of needing to grow up. And I think our sexual relationship in marriage is a real good classroom for us to need to grow up. In fact, I think it's a mirror of a lot of what goes on in our relationship in other ways. It's just more poignant here in marriage. If a person that tends to give in out of weakness or fear in my sexual relationship, I can bet that I'm doing that outside in other areas of my relationship with my husband and with other people. If I'm a person who's coercive and demanding and exploitive in my sexual relationship, I'm probably doing that in my business or in my other areas of my relationships. It's just bringing out the me in a very poignant way.
My comments were directed at a very specific scenario where it's only practical circumstances, weariness, sickness, or something that have made me unavailable. But yeah, if I have something to work on as the unavailable spouse, I have something to work on. I need to grow up. I need to understand the role of sexuality, the place for it, the value of it to my spouse. And therefore, if I'm being unavailable in a way that's selfish of me, that's where I need to stand before my God and decide I need to come to terms with this. I need to be more kind. I need to be more compassionate. I need to be more forthcoming. I need to be more giving toward my spouse, and I need to learn how to do that. That's absolutely right.
You know, just as a side note here, I find a lot with married couples that the woman often has less sexual desire than the man. And that's a real common thing. And it's something that a lot of women really, really do need to work with. I'm not suggesting that they muster up a desire equal to their husband, but that they, in the context of their being sexual together, that they're present, that they're interested, that they're involved in that relationship during their intimate encounter. And I may not ever get to the place where I desire it as much as my husband or nearly as much, but to nonetheless say, well, that's probably what's true for a lot of women, and nonetheless, this is something that I need to be involved in myself and not use it as a cop-out or as an excuse not to pursue an interest. And I see women doing that a whole lot, just saying, I'm just not interested. And so they're not pursuing it. And I do see that as wrong as, on the other hand, the other spouse demanding.
Yeah.
There needs to be... You know, I think a lot of people also, Jack, have a very difficult time being involved in sexual relationship because we think it should come naturally, and it just doesn't for any of us. We just, as in an emotional relationship, we really have to be in marriage to figure out how to emotional marriage relationship. We have to be in marriage to figure out marriage. It's the same with our sexuality. We have to be in a sexual relationship and pursue it and work with it and not just give up on it to learn it. And it really does take a lot of work, and it really is something we need to enter into with a lot of expectation that it's not going to be an easy thing. It's not just going to happen.
That's good.
So what we started with, Jack, is talking about self-control, and we're talking about self-control in the context of marriage. There's another area of self-control that we need to talk about, and that's masturbation. How do we need to use self-control in that area?
Yeah, the views on masturbation have ranged to the extremes among Christian thinkers and Christian philosophers. On the one hand, I read a book on sexuality by a Christian who was arguing that masturbation is the greatest gift that God has given to men, or something like that. He was talking about sexuality in the context of male sexuality, and that masturbation was the greatest gift that God had ever given to males, on the one hand. On the other hand, masturbation is treated by some people hysterically as just this awful, horrible, worst of all sins sort of thing. It's very strange that it gets such extreme reactions.
Very extreme.
Very extreme. My view is that for this very reason, if we talk about self-control, that masturbation is in fact morally inappropriate. And the reason being that I'm working on the assumption that it basically is nothing more or less than physical gratification, that it has no purpose beyond physical gratification. Now, to the extent that I might be wrong about that or that needs to be qualified, then my conclusions would have to be qualified. But work with me here for a second. If we're just simply engaging in physical gratification, then the act of masturbation is kind of the paradigm for turning my sexuality into a merely physical thing, and making me beast-like, making me animal-like. That certainly seems to dovetail with my experiencing in talking to other men, the kind of sense of being degraded and debased and, I guess just degraded and debased, that sense of being defiled that men have when they struggle with masturbation.
Defiled by their own selves.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's probably what, in a passage we looked at earlier, in an earlier program, Paul talks about in chapter 6, the 18th verse of 1 Corinthians. He says, "Flee immorality. Every sin that a man commits is outside the body, but the immoral man or the fornicator sins against his own body." And I've really wrestled with what Paul is saying there. What does he mean by that? It seems to me that what he's saying is that whereas every sin that a person commits is a sin against someone else, in one sense, but that some sins are also, in addition to that, a sin against our very own being, our very own self, and that fornication or sexual sin, sexual immorality is one of those. And I really see that acutely in masturbation, because people become their own victims when they have a persisting habit of masturbation. It leads to incredible depression. It leads to incredible self-hatred. It leads to incredible problems with their self-perception and acute emotional and psychological problems that I think comes from them being victims of their own disobedience. So I don't see anything ultimately good and appropriate coming out of masturbation. To call it the greatest gift that God gave to a man, sure cuts across the experience I have had with talking to man after man after man who struggles with masturbation. That's certainly not their experience. The point being, I think what we need to learn is to practice self-control and decide that if there is no sexual gratification to be had in a relationship with my spouse, then I will simply go without any sexual gratification.
So I can imagine somebody saying, "What?" to that? "What do you mean I'll go without? Didn't God give me this avenue of masturbation to be able to be sexually gratified if my husband or wife can't or won't?"
Well, that's what this person was saying, who's called it the greatest gift that God gave to man. I can't go there. I can't arrive at that conclusion. God gave sexuality to be a means to an end. It to be the means whereby I could communicate in this language of sexuality, communicate and celebrate and ratify and affirm the commitment that I have made to my spouse. If that is indeed, if I'm right about that, if that is indeed the purpose of sexuality, then to take something that was given to me and created to be a means to an end and to make it an end in itself, I'm just going to have orgasm for the sake of having orgasm, period, then that's to take the design of God's universe and to reinvent it, to decide God didn't know what he was doing, I'm going to devise a new use for sexuality. And that's at the heart of the kind of rebellion that we need to avoid. If we can take our cues from natural theology at all, it seems to me that we need to understand that sex was made for marriage. If it was made for marriage, it wasn't made for me. It wasn't made for merely self-gratification.
So you're basing your conclusion that masturbation really doesn't have a place on two things, as I understand it. One is that it really does lead to a psychological debilitation, that it's really hurtful and feels like a defilement against the self. You're also saying that masturbation is wrong because it is something I'm doing outside of the context of the scope that God made sexuality for. God made sexuality for being a communication of commitment and love between two people who are married.
Yeah, and the latter of those is actually my argument. I mean, that would be enough for me to persuade me that there's something morally inappropriate about masturbation. The other is an interesting corollary to that. It's interesting that an act that philosophically I have to conclude is an act of disobedience and rebellion against God ends up in our experience being so debilitating. That seems to confirm the conclusion in my mind. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is, what do I feel like when I am in fact so enslaved by and captivated by my passions that I can't say no to them? That I really have no self-control. I lose self-control. I can't say no to myself. What I feel like is an animal. I feel like an instinctual creature who is driven by his instincts. That is not someone made in the image of God. That is not someone created to be a moral being who can decide, I have these incredible urges to have sexual release, but it would be morally inappropriate, therefore I will not do it. That's the real dignity of humanity, is to be able to say to these strong, powerful, deep, surging physical urges within us, to say to them, no, because it would be wrong. Not say no because you are terrible, awful things. That's not why we're saying no to them. We're saying no to them because I want to enter into the beauty of doing what's right and loving and good, and this isn't it. When we are unable to do that, we come face to face with our own moral failing and weakness and debasement. I come face to face with that.
The ministry of Mackenzie Study Center is founded on a passionate desire to confront the truth of the gospel. Over the years, Mackenzie has offered classes, seminars, tutorials, counseling, conferences, and more to interested individuals. The staff at Mackenzie also write and offer to you the free monthly newsletter, News and Views. You might want to check out the News and Views titled, Bible Study for What Ails Us by Dr. Jack Crabtree. Jack takes on the popular sentiment that says being a Christian is just about loving Jesus and not about believing the right doctrine. Jack argues that although knowing the right doctrine is not enough to secure one's salvation, turning away from the pursuit of truth will lead one down the path of false spirituality. He says, from a human perspective, the only way any of us is going to survive is by grounding ourselves in the truth. The best way we can become grounded in the truth is by becoming grounded in the teaching of the Bible. And the only way we can become grounded in the teaching of the Bible is by making its study a priority. Call Mackenzie Study Center and get your copy of Bible Study for What Ails Us. The phone number is 541-485-4801. 541-485-4801. Now, back to Jack and Christine.
It's very clear that since we're talking about masturbation, that it's an issue that we think is one that's a problem for a lot of people. And it is. There's a very big difference in somebody making an error, tripping up, not, like we said in our last week's program, deciding that they want to really pursue God, but tripping and making mistakes, but maybe making lots of mistakes in this area, but still saying, I understand that I want to pursue what's right and good. I'm going to go in that direction. There's a difference between that and somebody saying, you know, I really don't care. I'm going to pursue what I want because I want, and I don't care what God says. And I would really encourage people to listen to last week's program. We were talking about a different issue, but I think it would give us insight in this one also. There are other contexts in which people may use masturbation, and this may need a longer discussion, but I'll just say it for now, and that's that for some people, having an acceptance or an understanding or a knowledge of their own body requires, or it's very helpful for people to be able to use masturbation as a tool to do that. There's very many people who are very uncomfortable or have no knowledge of their own bodies. And it's just a really important part of being able to be a sexual person in the context of marriage. However, if we're making a distinction between masturbation and self-stimulation in the context of being with your spouse, then it makes sense to me that self-stimulation is something where is very different and has a very appropriate context in the area of sexuality and marriage. But I also need to say that for some people that just doesn't feel possible. They're so highly uncomfortable with their body that they need some private time for understanding it and knowing it and bringing that with a desire of bringing that into later into their marriage, I think is an appropriate and good goal.
I'm not sure if I agree with that, although, or at least let me put it this way, it's very, very important that we make a distinction between masturbation and self-stimulation. The morality of self-stimulation as a sexual practice within the context of a sexual encounter in marriage is a whole different thing. And that has a whole different, to analyze that morally has to be analyzed completely differently. When I say masturbation, I mean isolated, lonely sex in solitude by myself. And what you're suggesting is maybe there's a time and place for that. Certainly self-stimulation in isolation for the sake of being able to better prepare myself in marriage is certainly morally different than what I'm talking about, namely self-gratification just for the sake of self-gratification. That's an entirely different thing morally as well. I'm not sure I would agree that it's morally desirable or morally acceptable, at least at its root, the kind of fear that would make me not be able in the context of a sexual encounter with my spouse to work that out is a fear that is in and of itself morally inappropriate, I think. And it's understandable, perhaps, but I would argue it's morally inappropriate. And we maybe have more to talk about.
It's too bad we're ending the show right here, but we're done.
Okay.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. 4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.